Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everyone. I am your host, Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One. As a reminder to those that are joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll see the chat room. That's a great place to jump in with the usual suspects. If you have an observation about the show, or if you don't think that we're going to get to a question that you think you would like our guest to answer, please put it up in the chat room. Both Eagle One and myself will be monitoring it, and we'll do our best to fold it in as the show goes along. Also, if you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on some prior shows, or you have to leave halfway through this one, you can always get the archive over Blog Talk Radio, or you can cheat and subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes and listen at your leisure. Also, occasionally on our show, this is a one-hour show, and if you're with us live, it will conk out right at an hour, but it keeps recording. We do have an after show if we need one. In that case, you can immediately get that over at the archive. If our guest is rounding out a point, or if there's just one more question we have to ask him because the conversation's going so well, we may go for a couple, maybe even 10, 15 minutes longer if needed. So don't feel like you've missed anything. Just pop into the archive and you'll be able to grab it. Now let's get on with the show. It's real easy to talk about ships and aircraft, personnel numbers. Also, programs are fun and interesting as they go through their different machinations and progress. But without a proper context, all we're doing is we're talking about expenditures and arguments over little pieces of equipment. There has to be a larger foundation you can connect these things to, and that's national policy and strategy. And from the political, strategic, to the operational and tactical, today on Midrats, we're going to focus on the Paul Mill and strategic levels. We're going to try to touch on the Pacific Pivot, air sea battle, AFPAC, what we may be seeing on the second and third order effects of the Arab Spring. And also in election year, things can get a little pointed there with the Potomac flotilla, so maybe we'll bounce on that as well. But there's a lot of stuff, as always, moving at the Paul Mill level and the strategic level. We've got a great guest on today, most of y'all are familiar with. Our guest for the full hour is going to be Dr. Robert Farley. He's the assistant professor at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce over at the University of Kentucky. Among other places, online and on DeadTree, where you can find his work. He also blogs about security and maritime issues over at Information Dissemination, and also Lawyers, Guns, and Money. And you can find a link to both of those over at my home blog. I also wanted to go ahead and give a tip out there. If you're not following Rob over at Twitter, you need to. It's at Dr. Farles, Delta Romeo, Foxtrot, Alpha Romeo, Lima, Sierra. Go ahead and add them to your Twitter feed. Rob, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks for having me, Sal.
Oh, really appreciate you taking time this Sunday to come chat with us. And I want to open up the questions. It's kind of a long one, so forgive me on this. But it's something that your post about the show today that you did over at ID, it brought a smile to my face because it's something that when I was a little pup during the Cold War, it was definitely still in my memory. And during the last phase of the Cold War, we really saw how it worked out during the first Gulf War. But the big concept there was the air-land battle with the Folda Gap and all that jazz. And here we find ourselves into the second decade after the fall of the Soviet Union. And now we have a lot of people talking about the air-sea battle concept. And with the air-land concept, it's pretty easy for anybody, even a layman, to connect the strategic and operational concepts of air land with an identified enemy, even a geography, and a national strategy as part of the conversation. But with a lot of the discussions with air sea, there's a lot of intentional hedging about, you know, who could be that mysterious person that you're best able to reach via air and land. And also, I think it's fair critique to say that our national security strategy is a little fuzzy right now. It's in flux. And besides the boy in blue air part of the equation, what do you see about the two concepts, your air land and your air-sea battle concepts? What do they share? What is similar about them? But what makes them different, especially in the context of where we are today?
Yeah, that is a long question, and so I may forget parts of it while I'm trying to answer it, but it's also a really interesting question. And one of the most interesting parts of it, and the article that I cited today over at ID sort of made this point, was that in some sense, the boys in blue part being part of both the air-sea battle and the air-land battle isn't quite right. That surely the Air Force and surely Air Force capabilities were part of air-land battle, but fundamentally, air-land battle was an Army doctrine, and it talked about how the Army thought about how the Air Force should operate. And the Air Force was willing to go with that for a variety of reasons, that you had sort of a nadir of Air Force doctrine at the time, that you had the dominance of TAC Air and all the fighter boys at the time, that you had the development of the A-10. And so there were a bunch of reasons why the Air Force found compatibility with the Army on air-land battle sort of pleasant and meaningful and something that they should be doing. But that in some sense it's different than what we have now with air-sea battle, where there really does seem to be a genuine level of cooperation and interest on both sides of the equation. I mean, it really does appear to be both the Navy and the Air Force interested in putting together a way of approaching whether, and I guess we'll get to this in a second, whether it's fighting China or whether it's simply sort of managing away the friction of inter-service conflict or whatever. But it's not the same sort of thing with air-land battle, which was very Army-driven. And sort of when you remember air-land battle, you remember it as an Army doctrine, right, not as an Air Force doctrine. And it's also kind of interesting, the argument that Sargal made, that the period in which air-land battle was developed was also a period where there was a very low level of conflict between the Army and the Air Force, and it sort of went up after the Gulf War with John Warden and so forth, and it had been higher during the Vietnam War. I just find that kind of inter-organizational thing really interesting, and it sort of suggests that there is a level of productivity in air-sea battle that could be reached, which is even higher than air-land battle, because it really that does kind of seem to me that you have both organizations genuinely interested in putting together a collaborative doctrine for presumably the Pacific, but not just other places. On the bigger strategic question, I just finally read the Greg Jaff article on air-sea battle in the Washington Post, and I thought it was awful. I guess Bill Sweetman has made the same point, and Galron over at Information Dissemination made the same point, it was talking about air-sea battle in context of how much money Andy Marshall had and how much money Andrew Krepinevich was going to get, and how this was just sort of an organizationally driven doctrine. I would love to talk about this too in the next hour. I'm by no means a foreign policy hawk, my attitudes on the defense budget certainly I think differ from a lot of people listening here, but it seems to me to be fairly obvious that as a matter of course, in the context of operating in the international system, you would prepare to fight the most powerful adversary who you have genuine disputes with. And so the quotes that were part of the Jaff article about how can we conceive of some sort of approach to fighting China, right? Because that's so destabilizing. There's also been some other articles about that, like Josh Rovner's article, which was good, but I think misplaced, and Thomas Barnett's a few of his articles too. In strategic terms, it seems clear to me that even whereas we can all imagine a fabulous number of reasons for not fighting China, and China can imagine a number of fabulous reasons for not fighting us, that the possibility of conflict still exists. And so the possibility of conflict, especially in this sort of unipolar situation where everything seems in flux and the world isn't nearly as black and white as it was in the Cold War, that preparation for, you know, one of the most potentially severe conflicts should be at the foremost of our minds. And so I guess, did that answer your question? Or are there parts of the question that I haven't answered yet?
I think your answer was better formed than my question, Eagle One.
Well, I mean, go ahead.
Well, I want to talk about China a little bit, because you've hit on a lot of stuff. You know, it's a gray area. We've got these interdependence things going on. We've had a number of, you've already pointed out a number of people who've commented this. I mean, Barnett seemed to think that there's the global interconnectivity of our globalized economy is enough to stop us from, in some ways, from needing to go to war over big things with them. But is it the gray area, minor issues, as they try and usurp more and more of the South China Sea and various islands, or reclaim them in their terms? I mean, what is it with China? How gray is this area, and is it just the old cold warrior in me looking for black and white enemies? Where do we stand on this?
You know, I mean, I think that Tom Barnett and others are correct to say that there is a pretty extreme difference between the way the world is now and the way the world is in the 80s. And, you know, this sort of comes out in the Red Dawn remake, right, where they had to change the victim or the assailants from Chinese to North Koreans.
Freudian slip.
Right, exactly. The problem is now, and it's not a problem, it's that the United States and China share a large number of interests in a way that the United States and the Soviet Union never did. You know, you have on the one that China is just sort of genuinely unenthusiastic about pushing any sort of ideological change in the world. They aren't enthusiastic about things that that increase instability in the world, right? They haven't. If this were the Cold War, one side or the other would be pouring money to the Taliban, but there's no indication that the Chinese have any interest in making the Taliban stronger, or that they really have that much interest in making Iran stronger. And in a lot of ways, their interests are fundamentally like our interests, right? They want a maritime space that enables as much transit and as much commerce and as much transport as possible. Now, I think that Tom and some other people take those facts and then leap to conclusions which aren't sustainable, which is that because our interests are fundamentally in line, there's not going to be any conflict. And I think that this is a wrong-headed way of looking at it because, you know, even to the extent that we both kind of want the same things in the long term, the spoils of the world we're looking for can be divided unequally. And the Chinese, whether rightly or wrongly, I think at this point, think that they don't have their fair share of the spoils of the world. And the second thing is that nationalism and pride and everything else that we talk about in terms of, you know, what makes nation states function and what makes national rivalry function certainly functions in the context of the U.S.-China relationship. And so there are going to be times where, you know, even if we can see this world where U.S. and Chinese interests basically cohere, that doesn't mean that they're not going to conflict, because we're not always going to rationally pursue those interests. Because there's going to be things like this nonsense over these little bitty islands between Korea and Japan and China. And this is not the South China Sea stuff, where there's genuine sort of resource conflict, but this is nationalist conflict. There's domestic pride and all sorts of other issues. And these are real serious issues that could lead to conflict, even between countries that fundamentally have, you know, the same outlook on the world.
You know, wars have happened for more stupid things out there. I mean, the human condition being what it is, applies both at the micro and the macro. And, you know, kind of while we're on that side of the world, you know, for the last few centuries, it's been very North Atlantic centric. Our traditional allies, especially since World War II, have been in Europe, and the news of the last decade is you know, though there was a lot of hope for otherwise, the economic, military, and demographic decline of our traditional European allies is pretty clear. But there are some other friends, or at least aggressively neutral nations out there that are rising powers. And when you look at them, are there some of those rising powers do you think is a really good idea that we are partnering with or should be increasing our partnership with out there just to help us keep our global influence?
Most of the countries that I see as rising global powers and ones that we need to maintain good relationships with in order to maintain global influence are countries that we're already pretty committed to maintaining global influence with. And this is obviously Australia, also South Korea, a few others. I mean, if there are two that I think are going to be particularly relevant to U.S. interests and that well, at the same time, are going to be relevant to American interests, but that we have real, genuine disputes with, or potential disputes with, I would say Turkey and India, that these are two countries which are located in areas and which have the sufficient economic and military strength to play major roles in places that we really care about. And so building, and, you know, obviously with Turkey, we already have a strong security relationship with, but there has been tension for a variety of reasons. And India, people talk a lot about this future alignment of India and the United States, but they also still remain strongly aligned with Russia in a lot of ways. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, India does what's in India's interest. But if I were to say two areas in which the United States could focus its diplomacy, could work better to build strong and cohesive relationships with, and really ought to do so, it's those two countries. That those two countries are going to be important players in the places where we want to be important players in the future.
You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about, you mentioned Mahan, and there was a pretty good piece on information dissemination by Professor Rubble from the Naval War College, who implied or suggested that the Mahanian view of naval power isn't really applicable anymore. Did you read that? Do you agree with that?
I read as much of Barney's stuff as I could, and I read almost everything on information dissemination that I can. But I have to confess that I don't remember reading exactly that piece. I remember him writing it, but I don't remember reading it. On the general issue, is Mahan still relevant? I absolutely think that Mahan remains relevant. It remains a compelling way of structuring how we think about managing the commons, and of connecting the management of the commons with national power. And I think that it then gets sort of to the crux of what we might be looking forward to in terms of a conflict between the United States and China, because Mahan isn't exactly zero-sum in terms of, or perhaps I should say Mahan is more zero-sum than he should be in terms of thinking about the management of the commons, where, you know, one major power can benefit and then sort of exclude other major powers. And so in some sense, we might want to modify Mahan to think about how two major potential maritime powers, or one major maritime power and one potential major maritime power, can work through the management of the commons and avoid some of the more nasty competitive aspects. And that sort of takes us away from Mahan in a sense, but also leaves us with Mahan as a starting point. And when Mahan is a starting point, that means we still have to read him, we still have to engage with him, we still have to think through the implications of what he writes for, you know, for structure, for everything else. And so, I mean, I think that we are still living in a Mahanian world because Mahan had a very compelling way of explaining how naval power relates to national power.
Rob, I just finished the audio book of Peter Schweitzer's book on the basically the Reagan administration in the last part of the Cold War, titled Victory. And in it, he describes in pretty fair detail the penultimate acts of the Soviets in Afghanistan prior to, you know, General Boris Gromov's walk across the Friendship Bridge and the follow-on government in Kabul and its eventual fall. And it was pretty obvious that whole series of events who benefited. It was the anti-Soviet West. And another thing that's interesting about it, when you look at those penultimate acts, including the time where Najibullah was brought to Moscow and sat down and he was told, by the way, we're withdrawing in a little more than 2 years, and then the fight's up to you, we'll help train you and supply you, et cetera, and so forth. It reminds me a lot of a lecture I set in on a retired Soviet two-star who was there in 84 and 86. The parallels are striking. And we know that we're packing up and going home here pretty soon. If the play in broad terms follows what happened when the Soviets departed and the government they left behind couldn't sustain itself, I guess the big question would be, who would benefit from that?
Nobody? I don't know. It sounds really bad
I
for
agree.
Everyone. the idea of I guess in the short term, Pakistan benefits to an extent, although I think even now Pakistan, I just read Anatole Levin's new book on Pakistan, and that talks a little bit about how Pakistan has soured on the Taliban. I mean, a lot of people talk about how Pakistani relationship has soured, but over the past 4 or 5 years, the Pakistani government, the Pakistani military have really soured on the Taliban. And if we have a Najibullah scenario where Karzai is strung up in the streets of Kabul and essentially the Taliban regains whatever power that held previously, I don't think anybody benefits. I mean, the Russians, it's going to be very bad for them because they don't want that sort of extremism feeding into their client states in the Central Asia. They don't want that feeding into Chechnya and other areas. I don't think the Chinese want that because they're worried about Xinjiang. And the Indians certainly don't want it because they don't want either of those sorts of people operating in Kashmir. Now, I guess the follow-up question to that is, once we agree that this is good for absolutely nobody except for the Taliban, and I don't even exclude the Afghan people, because if the Taliban return to power, there's going to be another bloodbath. Why don't more countries do something to prevent that? And I think part of the answer is that, just as we can talk about how China and the United States may have fundamentally the same vision of what the maritime sphere ought to look like, they can't necessarily agree on how to make it so. And I think in this situation, too, right, even though almost everyone thinks that it would be bad if the Taliban regained power in Afghanistan, there is very little interest in spending a lot of money to do the stuff that is necessary to prevent that. Now, at the same time, I should say that I think that a Najibullah scenario is unlikely in Afghanistan. I think it's unlikely because, on the first hand, the Soviet-sponsored Afghan regime did manage to survive. It survived for almost as long as the Soviet Union survived. And I suspect that the United States is going to be giving levels of support to the Karzai government or to whatever successor of Karzai there is, that at least equal what the Soviets gave to Najibullah. And second, I think that the Karzai regime is at least marginally stronger than the Najibullah regime was, and is more legitimate than the Najibullah regime was, despite all of the problems that it has. That U.S. behavior in Afghanistan is still a far cry from what Soviet behavior was from 1981 to 1988. And so I am optimistic that we won't have an Najibullah scenario in the sense that we're going to see Karzai and co. strung up from street lamps in Kabul.
As we make the Pacific pivot, is that a strategy? And if it is a strategy, what equipment issues to kind of go back to what Sal started out with? What should our forces look like to do a Pacific pivot?
Well, Well, I mean, I think a Pacific pivot is a grand strategic shift. I mean, that's a sort of a straightforward grand strategic decision. And I guess I think we're going to get to domestic politics later. It's interesting to me that there doesn't seem to be much conflict over the notion that we ought to have a Pacific pivot. I mean, Governor Romney hasn't, you know, certainly assailed President Obama on a number of points about force structure and size and so forth, but he hasn't made the argument that we need to pay more attention to Europe or anywhere else. So I think it's certainly a grand strategic move to the extent that we're actually going to do it. You know, in terms of what the Department of Defense should look like and what more broadly the military-industrial base should look like, I think that the answers here are also kind of obvious. You know, when we're doing a Pacific pivot, what we need to do is focus more cleanly on air and maritime capabilities, which means that, you know, and the Army understands this, right? The Army understands that this means that it's going to get shortchanged. And the Marines perhaps a little bit different, but certainly the Marines in how they envision their current roles in certain ways, maybe they'll be less shortchanged than the Army, but they may still see some reduction in capability in favor of more maritime and air capabilities, because we don't really envision fighting the Chinese on the ground, even on Formosa. And I think the problem with that is that, you know, from a fairness point of view, it really looks like the Army and the Marine Corps bled their hearts out in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then for all of that, they get punished by being dropped in the aftermath in favor of the two services that at least did less in visible terms to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think, you know, there are a lot of mechanisms in the United States government which militate against open inter-service conflict, and it's going to be hard to actually accomplish a shift of financial and military resources away from ground-based capabilities that we may not need in a Pacific pivot, and towards the sort of maritime and air capabilities that we do need to carry out the, you know, a new grand strategic approach.
My favorite Princess Bride quote: "You just committed the greatest strategic blunder. You got involved in a land war in Asia." That's one of my biggest reasons to support the air sea battle doctrine. The over at the blogging heads, which I do greatly appreciate the beard and baseball cap look. It's always very good to have up on the internet. The over at blogging heads. You and Taylor Frabel had this, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, Frabel.
Yeah.
Y'all discuss civil-military relations in China. What are some of the issues that y'all discussed over there during your discussion?
Well, we talked about how relations between the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army have changed over the past 20 years. You know, for the first generation of the People's Republic of China, there was an extraordinarily tight connection between the army and the party, because a lot of the main actors in the party were fundamentally people who had been at the core of the army during the revolution, and they had their own army groups that would support them, and these would support them in political conflicts in Beijing, and they would provide this source of stability that they could rely on, and so there was a tight connection between the army and the party. But since Deng Xiaoping, and especially Deng Xiaoping's later years, that's really changed. And there does now seem to be a genuine distinction between the high-level military and the high-level party that's emerged. And, you know, because all of the party people now don't have military experience. And so, you know, there was a great report from, and it was some Swedish institute, and I can't off the top of my head remember the name, but there was a really good report on the sources of Chinese foreign policy that talked about how over the past 10 or 15 years, as a result of this this divide, you've really begun to see more and more conflict between the preferences of the military on foreign policy and the preferences of the civilian leadership. And this is, you know, played out in a bunch of different ways. Sometimes the civilian leadership will sort of act to sort of preempt the military on issues. Other times the military will push the civilian leadership into things it doesn't necessarily want to do. And what Taylor and I talked about was how this played out in context of the Bo-Xilai affair and also the South China Sea. And in terms of Bo-Xilai, there were some arguments that Bo-Xilai, who was this essentially the mayor of Chongqing, who has effectively been purged now, how he was relatively popular among the military, and how we can sort of read his purging as a pushback from some of the party officials against the military. But there's also something going on in the South China Sea where, from what we can tell, and this is all Kremlinology, right? It's forbidden cityology in the way that it used to be Kremlinology. It really does seem like the military is pushing harder than the leadership on moving into the South China Sea, and that the leadership may be trying to slow down the military, whether successfully or not. Now, I think the next question is going to be in China is inter-service conflict, where, you know, even though the PLA is the big player, they have a very similar thing going on where it's really kind of obvious that the Air Force and the Navy and the 2nd Artillery are going to be bigger players in any conflict with the United States. And that conflict is going to have some really interesting implications in terms of how the Chinese leadership acts with regards to force structure, with regards to procurement, and so forth. And so I think it's going to be a lot of fun, so to speak, to watch how the Chinese react to those problems.
Well, as they say on Monty Python, let's do something completely different. We advertise and we talk about the Arab Spring. And so let's talk a little about the Arab Spring and what's going on in Syria and where you see all that stuff shaking out as we go along.
Oh, I really have no idea what's going to happen in Syria. I would like to spread this idea. Something I call the Pundit Blogger Accountability Act, which it's this post that I write at Lawyers, Guns, and Money every January 1st, making predictions about what's going to happen in the next year. Sort of under the argument that if you're a pundit or a blogger, you should be accountable for the stupid things that you say over the course of the year. And you guys can go back and search. It's terrible. It's really remarkable. You know, I've had years where I'm like 3 for 27. And there's stuff like Yankees going to win the AL East and stuff in there. And that's like the 3. And then I get 24 things wrong. And so there's, you know, one of the things that I said in this year's pundit blogger accountability post was that that Assad would still be president on December 31st, 2012. And while I think that that's probably still going to be the case, I don't see a long-term future for that regime. And I think that most people who are watching what's going on, right, even to the extent that the Syrian regime can win certain battles against the rebels, it doesn't seem like it has a tremendously long future. But at the same time, I think that everybody's struggling with what an acceptable or reasonable or useful policy response is to this fight between the rebels and the regime, right? Because on the one hand, as a lot of people pointed out, we don't have a fabulous grasp on exactly who the rebels were and exactly who the rebels are and what they're going to do if and when they win. And second, this isn't a case like we have in Libya where you can use air power to pick off individual Libyan tanks being driven down the road on the way to fight the rebels. This is a much more messy situation that's harder to figure out a way to impose air power on. Long term for the Arab Spring, I think democracy is great, and so then therefore I think that moving these countries, however slowly, in the direction of democracy, and we don't even really know in Egypt's case whether that's the direction we're moving, but I think that it is. This is a good thing. In the short and medium terms, it's really going to be a problem for the United States. It's going to be a problem for Turkey, and it's going to be a problem for Israel especially. And I think the Israelis are really comfortable with that. The Israelis understand that more democracy in this region is a problem for them in a way that you can't really talk about in the same context in American political culture. I mean, sort of we can talk about abandoning Mubarak and so forth, but even that sort of nobody really wants to say, oh, you know, we abandoned our dictator friend in Egypt in a major foreign policy debate. But so I guess I would say, you know, long-term outlook is good. Short and medium-term outlooks are very problematic for the Arab Spring.
Yeah, I guess if we lived in a perfect world before there was an Arab Spring, the Egyptians would have invested a little bit of their defense money in an education. I had an Egyptian expat describe to me, I forget the numbers he gave me, it's like Egypt's a great country of 1 million educated modern people and 40 million uneducated people who are ready to riot or something to that effect. It's, I think you're right, short and the medium term, I think fences and a wary eye is smart, and hopefully in the long term, the forces of the good side of the spectrum will play out. And I think you're exactly right about Syria, too. I would encourage everybody to go up on Google Earth, do a flyover of northern Libya, then do a flyover of the western 20% of Syria, and you'll see the difference in the challenge. Fitting with Eagle One's challenge of going different, let me shift again to a question that I think you're in a really good spot to do, because you're inside, but you're also outside to a certain extent. And something that has bothered me even more since 2009, since I retired, it bothered me on active duty as well, but it has to do with the uniformed military connection and a part of the military-industrial complex. Is with some programs, it just seems that at times, from four stars down to your journeyman PAOs, that we seem to be part of the defense industry as opposed to acting like a customer of. How do you see that interreaction between being the customer and perhaps defending programs that are in ways indefensible? Is that system broken, or is it just the nature of the connection?
Right. I've been plowing through for a bunch of stuff that I'm working on. I've been plowing through the really excellent history of the Office of the Secretary of Defense series, which is a series so far of six volumes, each of which is like 900 pages, and they've only gotten from I think 1947 to 1968 over the course of 20 years. I mean, they've been writing for 20 years, and they're still only to 1968. And these issues.
Who's writing that?
Oh, it's a variety of different historians, but it's under the aegis of the Office of the Secretary of Defense. So just do a Google search like History Office Secretary of Defense, and these are all, you know, really interesting, well-written books. They are all free, even better. You can just download them and read them on your iPad or your computer or whatever else. And they're all a ton of detail on stuff like the B-36 supercarrier debate and so forth. You know, I'm going to guess that kind of what you're fishing for here is a comment on the LCS and on that interesting report that came out a couple days ago from, I think, Aviation Weekly on, you know, to the extent to which the Navy has tried to cover up problems with the LCS. You know, I mean, I think that ever since we've adopted our current procurement strategy, which involves the public, which involves Congress, which involves the uniformed military, and then the defense industrial complex, there's been a problem of how to explain really complex technical issues that sort of are easily demagogued, but that don't necessarily translate well. And so I think, I mean, what I read from that Aviation Weekly story in the LCS, and if you haven't read it, then go out and take a look at it because it really is pretty interesting, was that this was a bunch of people who were pretty interested in making sure that the problems with the first littoral combat ship were not blown out of proportion. And in the context of making sure that they weren't blown out of proportion, may have minimized the problems with the first ALCS well beyond what the degree to which they should have been minimized. And you know, from and I can't really speak from an inside perspective, because on this issue I'm a double outsider, right? I'm not part of the military industrial complex, and I'm not part of the uniformed military. You know, so I see it in terms of organizational prerogative and institutional prerogative, and you know, it seems to me that whatever the decisions that the Navy has to make down the line on the LCS, the Navy wants to make those decisions on its own and doesn't want to be forced to make those decisions by Congress. And so lots of stories about how any given way, and I think both the Air Force and the Navy have the same issue with the F-35, and the Air Force had the same issue with the F-22, that minimizing to the extent possible the issues with a particular weapon system, leave it more or less in the hands of the service to deal with those problems, rather than letting Congress and the public deal with those problems. And a great example of this is the OV-22, where, you know, every story I've ever heard from an operator is that they love this thing, that it's a you know, it fills an important gap, that it works and everything else. And yet the popular perception of it is that it's a tremendously problematic weapon. And I think that the reason you see so many people on the inside essentially going to bat for weapon systems that are pretty questionable, like the F-35 and the LCS, is they don't want this to happen. What happened with the OV-22, where it got a reputation that it didn't need because of stories that were accurate but sort of misleading about the direction that the program was going. And that obviously has a lot of good and bad outcomes.
Yeah, I could tell a boring story about the early B-52s falling out of the sky that would have stopped them being put into service for several years had they had the current attitude that the OV-22s and the LCSs have. But somehow they overcame that, and that aircraft has been around now about 55 years, I think. There are some questions that I think Claude asked a pretty good one. Are we getting to a situation where the consolidation in the defense industry has put the defense industry and the power to kind of control the military?
On your first point there, with regards to the B-52, I put up some statistics on the blog a while ago after the 60 Minutes report about the sort of the genuine problems with the F-22's breathing apparatus, comparing the loss rates of the F-22 with the F-100 and the F-104 and even the F-15 and F-16. And, I mean, the F-22 was the safest fighter to fly, even with all the problems. And so it's definitely a genuine concern. Misunderstandings of exactly how effective this equipment is. You know, with regards to defense-based consolidation, my wife and I actually wrote an article together about, Eugene Goltz and Pete Dombrowski. Dombrowski is at the Naval War College, and Eugene is at, I forget where right now. They wrote a great article about the defense industrial base, or a great book about the defense industrial base, that talked about how one of the reasons we have defense consolidation, and one of the reasons you can't break defense consolidation, is because only the big defense industries can really navigate the extraordinary complexity of the defense procurement system, that we've made the system so amazingly complex, and we've drawn so many connections between the private industry on the one hand and the uniformed military, and then certain actors in Congress, that it's almost impossible for us to have new firms become part of the defense industrial complex. And so we have old firms eating each other, we have old firms eating new firms, but we never have new firms becoming a new part of it, because there are a whole bunch of mechanisms by which older firms can just chase out new firms, or can completely destroy new firms. And they can do so with what is effectively the connivance of the government and of the uniformed military. And Secretary Rumsfeld, and this was a really good idea from Secretary Rumsfeld, you know, made a concerted effort to try to bring civilian firms that weren't that weren't hadn't previously been operating in the defense sector and try to bring them into the defense sector. And there was a, I think there was a post at a defense news or somewhere, why don't we just order an iFighter from Apple? You know, the answer is that Apple and other other corporations that might be interested in government contracts simply don't have the relationships. They don't have the expertise. They don't have the know-how to navigate the system because the system is ridiculously complicated. An article that my wife and I wrote, we talked about how this one small firm had attempted to sell a coupler, which was probably going to be used for undersea cable tapping, to the government, and essentially just had their inventions clean stolen by another firm that was already working with the Pentagon, and there was nothing they could do about it because state secrets privilege was claimed, and you know, effectively made it impossible to claim any patent rights on their own inventions. And companies understand this, and they don't want to work with the defense, with the government and the Department of Defense, because they understand that these things are going to happen.
I tell you what, Rob, I mean, you hit on a subject I would love to do a two-hour panel on, because I think you hit spot on it when you're looking at, you know, what are fundamental problems. You can nibble on the edges and, you know, make an object look nice and smooth and cleaned up, but if at its foundation there is something that is rotten and worm-eaten, it's going to undermine the entire structure. Our procurement system is exactly it. Now, how do you break that, Gordon? I don't know. There'd have to be a smarter person with a lot more top cover than anybody I know, but boy, that is a foundation stone that's got to be fixed and replaced. I don't know how we do it. Another foundation stone we have, thank you very much. When I was on active duty, there's always a thing when people are looking at their retention numbers. You never want people to leave. My take was always, hey, if somebody wants to, they've served their country for a few years, if they want to go on, they want to go forward, you know, put your arm around them, help them in their transition, because that second-class petty officer that's leaving today is going to be the congressman in 20 years. Let him have a good memory so he can be part of the solutions down the road. It's always good to have those people out there. And within driving distance of where I live now is the university where I got my graduate degree, and they have an alumni association for veterans. And one of the things that we do is partner with the veterans in the university. Obviously, they're older. A lot of them have families. That makes them different than your average student. But also they have a little broader world experience, and a few of them have some other issues from their service. And we try to help them with everything from schedule planning to transition to cultural issues. It's nice to do. And part of the thing that we had to fight in the university is the perfect example was a meeting I was at with an administrator who was talking about our association. He said, oh, that's so great because, you know, all the veterans come back with PTSD issues. And I almost bit through my tongue trying to control my verbiage because there's a lot of misunderstanding of veterans around campus. Now, you're over at the University of Kentucky, and almost every university has a variety of veterans on the campus. Do you run into them much in the seminar halls and in the classrooms and on campus? And if so, besides their age difference, is there something different about, especially in the area of your expertise, of having a veteran there in your group of students, or do they just kind of blend in with the background?
This is going to be a long answer. So I have, you know, at the University of Kentucky, the only people I teach are graduate students, because the Patterson School is a graduate foreign policy program, and so I don't see many undergraduates. When I was back at the University of Washington, I did teach undergraduates, and I had a lot of ROTC students, I had enlisted students, I had veterans, but this was back in 2004, and so what I didn't have was a lot of people who came back from either Iraq, Afghanistan, and had experiences that they needed to talk about or wanted to talk about it, or experiences they could bring into the classroom. So what I can talk about is sort of in my particular context, as a guy who teaches graduate students, you know, I can say I teach security classes, and it is invaluable to have someone with military experience in the course. And, you know, from my point of view, that's really not going to be all that surprising. because, you know, they can talk about all of the operational and tactical details that, you know, everyone can be made to understand politics and grand strategy to an extent. It's harder to convey the tactical and operational stuff, and it is just almost imperative that you have someone who has experience with those kinds of issues in your class. And, you know, in the past we have had, we've had active duty, we've had retired vets, we've had reservists here, and, you know, all of them are have done very well, even though, you know, from time to time there's a bit of impatience with the civilians. You know, on the sort of larger issue of the reintegration of veterans into the academy and into regular classes, I think it depends a lot on the institution and a lot on how much the institution is willing to commit to providing resources for veterans and also to educating faculty and educating administrators about, it's wrong to say special needs, but about the issues that have with veterans. And you know, smart people understand that PTSD is one of these issues, but it's not a primarily one of the issues, right? There's a whole bunch of things, just in terms of how, you know, their older students are more experienced, they have, you know, all of the things you just mentioned, and it makes it a different experience teaching a veteran-heavy undergraduate class than it does one that just has a bunch of 18-year-old freshmen. And from my understanding, talking to people in the academy, there are places that do this more, they do this better and they do this worse. And I think, not to tout my own organization, I think University of Kentucky does it fairly well, but I think that's because the University of Kentucky also has a larger veteran population than some other institutions. Now, one thing which I've had argued to me, and I tend to believe, is that, and you can, you know, again, you can take this with a grain of salt because I'm in the traditional academy and not the for-profit academy, but that institutions like the University of Phoenix and so forth, for-profit institutions, tend to make a lot of money taking advantage of veterans. And I almost had a retired Army captain yell this at me, how he was, you know, doing his best to try to convince these returning enlisted personnel, do not do University of Phoenix, do what the officers are doing, right? When you see an officer get out, they go to somewhere like the University of Kentucky. They don't go to the University of Phoenix. And he had a lot of trouble making that argument to enlisted personnel who had retired and were now looking to go and get a degree and move on. And places like Phoenix, you know, they pitch specifically to people who have GI Bill money and so forth. And so that's a problem, and that's a problem that, you know, there may be administrative ways of dealing with. You know, but again, you know, I don't teach undergraduates anymore, and so I haven't experienced this post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan wave of veterans that we've had in the academy.
Well, let me kind of follow up on that. One of the advantages it would seem to me to have a veteran in your class who had been through those experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan or even the Desert Storm or Kosovo and any of the other ones is that the impact of the strategic and diplomatic decisions that get made are most keenly felt by the guy at the point of the spear. And would that enter into your discussions at all in your classes?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the discussion, but certainly. I think that every security class that we have always talks about the military services as organizations. And when we talk about them as organizations, we also talk about them in the context of the personnel that are part of those organizations. And, you know, we also talk a little bit about civil-military relations and how civil-military relations differ now from the situation where the draft existed and where you had a much greater penetration of the military into civilian life. And that's not quite the right word for it, but you had a much greater degree of military experience among the civilian population. And so we talk about that, and we talk about how that has changed some strategic decision making, especially how people think about how that's changed strategic decision making. So we talk about questions like, you know, does the elimination of the draft, does the all-volunteer force make us more or less likely to go to war? And how does it affect how the population thinks about war and so forth? So I do think that, we do talk about that kind of stuff in my classes at least.
One thing we put out in the pre-show that we haven't touched on yet, and I want to tee up a ball for you. But with the, in the middle of the election season, inside of 90 days from Election Day, this, you know, ignoring the distraction issues and the piddly stuff, the big media issues that both parties and the candidates are talking about, it's the economy, jobs, jobs, economy, economy, jobs, jobs. We don't see, unlike the last couple of presidential elections, much of a wedge of time devoted to national security issue. History doesn't stop. It keeps going whether you pay attention to it or not. If Rob Farley had a magic wand and could pick three subjects on a national security that you wish were part of the conversation that both President Obama and Mr. Romney would discuss, what their thoughts and their plans are, what would those three national security or diplomatic areas do you think really need to be part of this conversation?
Well, I'm going to cheat here a little bit. I'm only going to pick one, and I'm going to pick one, and it refers back to what Galran did with information dissemination in June, and he turned over the blog to a lot of guest writers, and among those guest writers were John Lehman, and I forget who was on the Democratic side. It doesn't really matter, and talked about how their campaigns thought about naval strategy, and I thought that this was, you know, obviously I thought this was a fantastic idea because I like talking about naval strategy, but I also thought that on the part of the campaigns it was a missed opportunity. I think that there is a fantastic, and more than fantastic, a digestible and understandable conversation to be had right now on naval strategy. We've had points in the last 100 years where naval strategy, naval procurement has been understandable and really important to Democratic elections, not just in the United States and other places. They talked about, if you read Andrew Gordon, if you read others talking about the naval race before World War I, the number of battleships and the name of the last battleship were on the lips of everyone wandering around London in 1912, and they were real genuine arguments. Now, I think in our current right now, today, people have other important things going on, and obviously the economy is one of those really important things going on. But there is a very interesting debate to be had between if we can fairly argue that the Obama administration is pursuing a liberal internationalist grand strategy, and the Romney administration would prefer what we might term a neo-hegemonic grand strategy. And I don't want to sort of preemptively discard either of those, although my sympathies are with Obama on this. That's a really interesting debate to have, and it's one that naval strategy really matters for. And one of the contributors to information dissemination, Brian McGrath, has developed a lot of good critiques of the cooperative strategy. And from my point of view, the cooperative strategy is almost straight down the line, in line with the liberal internationalist view. And Secretary of State Clinton gave a really interesting speech to the Naval Academy, which essentially made that argument, made the same argument that the cooperative strategy is a strategy for liberal internationalism. And so what I would love, and what I think would be useful, and it would be educative, and it would even be interesting, and you know, maybe I doubt it would be consequential, but it might, would be a genuine commitment from either side to having that argument, because I think on both sides, from their points of views, they could turn it into a compelling case for their visions of how to think about the world, right? Not necessarily a resolved pro cooperative strategy or a resolved anti-cooperative strategy, but something about naval doctrine in those terms that would draw a sharp line between two different views of America's role in the world. So that's what I would really, that's what I'd really like, and it's the one thing that I'd really like in terms of national security and foreign policy in this election. And while we've had more talk about the Navy in this election than in some previous ones, we haven't had that conversation.
Well, Rob, that's a great answer, and we're running out of time, so I want to thank you for appearing on MidRats with us today. And we'd like you to come back, and we'll spend another 2 or 3 hours dissecting your brain with more questions. And appreciate you being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been really great, Rob, and I appreciate you taking the Sunday out. And I appreciate everybody that were joining us live, and, of course, our friends over in the archive. I want to thank everybody for joining us, and join us again next week for another edition of MidRats. Hope everybody has a great Navy Day.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary.
Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.